Welcome to Saga Briefs, where we're looking at the stories behind the sagas. I'm John.
And I'm Andy. And this is the first in our promised multi-part series on the uses and misuses of Norse history and literature in the modern world.
Right. So this is a series we've been talking about doing for a while. And there's nothing new about the idea that some people look to the past for a justification of their own beliefs and prejudices.
Yeah, but it has taken on an added urgency in the last few years, unfortunately. And that's not just because of events like Charlottesville and the Capitol riot in the U.S., but there's various nationalists and extremist groups rising up throughout the Western world.
Yeah, and of course, Norse history isn't the only field being mined and misused by these groups, but there's definitely a resonance for some of them with the Viking past, or we should say, what they want to believe the Viking past was.
Exactly. Yeah. Now, as we've said before, we are not experts on this subject.
No.
But fortunately, we managed to find a couple of scholars who are.
Yes. And as this is the first episode we're doing on the subject, we wanted something of an introduction to the issue. So we'll be asking our guests, Verena Hofig and Zachary Melton, to speak about the phenomenon of modern groups who look to the sagas or Norse myths and poetry for texts that dictate or validate a worldview relevant to their lives and their faith.
For most of these people, the sagas and Eddas inspire a life of spiritual meaning, or to live a life attuned to the world of nature and of simple truths. But for a few, the past is invoked as justification for racial hatred or nationalism or even cultural chauvinism. And I think that our guests are going to make clear in this interview that is a small percentage of those who look to the past for meaning. But
yeah, unfortunately, they're a loud small percentage.
Yeah.
Media coverage is unsurprisingly, people are less inclined to report on the thousands of people reading and enjoying this literature or this historical culture the way that our best research tells us it was. But people who twist that history or who deliberately or inadvertently learn the wrong lessons from the literature, that's also part of the story. And unfortunately, it's the part that gets an outsized focus.
Yeah, yeah. Now, we are going to be drawing attention to it ourselves now, so we are contributing to that, but
right.
Part of the point here
balances 100 episodes or so that we've done on the other side of the ledger.
Exactly, yeah, no, and it's part of a complex story, you know? Violence and cultural essentialism is part of the story. But, of course, the full history is much bigger and much less simplistic than people arguing for some sort of racially homogenous past think it is. Mm-hmm. I think one thing we know about the European North is that a mono-ethnic identity was basically never the default there.
Right. I think there are two equally misguided errors that are very easy to fall into when you're thinking about history. One is to assume that people weren't fully realized human beings, living lives that are just as full and just as complex as our own. Mm-hmm. And the other is to assume that their identities and their preoccupations were the same as ours.
Yeah, and I think there's a third error there, which is to assume that we're looking back on history from a necessarily more enlightened position ourselves.
Oh, right. Absolutely. This is the mantra of every course I teach. Part of the complexity is that Norse literature and culture isn't just one thing, because history never is. One of the ways you can tell you're dealing with someone who's misusing history is that they tend to speak of it in absolutes.
Yeah.
Human beings don't really inhabit absolutes, at least the interesting ones don't. And history only conforms to neat binaries when we cheat it of its reality to make it serve ours.
Yeah. And I would say even the people that claim to live by absolutes, they themselves are complex creatures, mm-hmm. right? So what we're trying to get at here is this is a big subject. And there are a lot of aspects that we want to get into, which is why this will be a sort of sub-series within the Saga Briefs.
Right. An occasional series. Right? We've still got a lot of other work to do around here. We've got a lot of sagas to discuss. And in fact, we're already deep in our prep for the next saga we're covering, which is Fólksbrota saga, the saga of the Sworn Brothers.
Right. Which that's a great one. It's on the second tier of sagas, I think. Not as famous as an Ale or Njal, but a well-regarded and pretty widely discussed saga. So I'm looking forward to it.
Right. And that should be coming along in just a few weeks. We've sure also got a saga short. Well, you know. A few, Andy, like 3 to 5, right? A few is a usefully vague term.
Gotcha.
Now, in the meantime, we're also doing a saga short, which I think we announced last time, right? Gisli Ilugason's Tale.
Yeah, it's a great one. I'm looking forward to that. It's a lot of fun. To add to all of that, our semesters are ending while we're up to all of this. So we try to keep busy around here.
There is no off button on the saga machine, Andy. All right. So for this episode, we've brought together a couple of scholars working in the field of modern uses of the Viking and Norse past, the post-medieval work, right?
That's right. Yeah. So we've got Verena Hofik from the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and Zachary Melton, a doctoral student at the University of Iceland.
We are excited to have them on the podcast.
Yes. Verena Hofik is an assistant professor at Urbana-Champaign in the Department of Germanic Languages and Literatures. And she also spends time on archaeological digs while stationed around Uppsala in Sweden. She's written on a variety of topics connected to the post-medieval reception of Viking Age mythology and literature. And her most recent publication is as a contributor to the collection Old Norse Myths as Political Ideologies, with an essay titled Rewild Yourself, Old Norse Myth and Radical White Nationalist Groups in Trump's America.
Our second guest, Zachary Melton, is a man of parts. He's a former 911 emergency dispatcher and touring musician who's now completing a PhD in Icelandic and Comparative Cultural Studies. His work focuses on the changing portrayals of Vikings in American popular culture, with a particular focus on the themes of gender, religion, and race in novels and film from the 19th century to the present. His most recent project for publication is a study of the use of Old Norse literature and imagery in the U.S. women's suffrage movement of the early 20th century. And he's also been contributing over the last few years to Emily Lethbridge's Icelandic Saga map, which is one of our favorite resources here at Saga Thing.
I do love that map.
I know you do. It's like they made a toy just for you.
Yes, they did. All right. Well, we're very happy to welcome Verena and Zachary. Thanks for coming on the podcast.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you very much.
Good to see you guys.
My pleasure. So, Verena, you open your article with a rather important question, and one that I think is appropriate for the opening of this interview as well. You say, what is it that makes medieval culture in general and Old Norse or even Germanic culture more specifically so popular amongst white supremacist groups in the United States and in Europe? That's a big question. And of course, we know it's not just medieval imagery and culture that's being used by these groups. We also see Spartan imagery and Roman imagery and even Native American imagery. So I guess, broadly speaking, a very tough question to open with. What is the appeal of co-opting and misappropriating familiar historical cultures and images?
What a question. Yeah, I mean, I raised that question in my article because I wanted to find an answer, and I'm actually still looking for answers. And as you rightly point out, of course, it is not just Old Norse or Germanic culture and antiquity that's of interest here. You pointed out Spartan, ancient Roman and Greek mythologies that are abused and used by these groups. So what I like to think about is oftentimes that people, you know, they search historical cultures for answers for problems they have in the present, of course. I mean, our entire interest in history may be guided by who we are in the present. And if you want, you could even define history as something that is actually invented by various presents as we're trying to answer important questions. And I think that's also what's going on here. And, you know, people's use and abuse of medieval Northern culture is, of course, just a small segment of it. Still, I feel, and, you know, perhaps I'm prejudiced here, I feel that there is an increased visibility of especially cultural contents taken from medieval Norse culture in perhaps what we've seen here in the United States in the past 4 or 5 years. And the way I've started to think about this is that perhaps the medieval North, even more so than perhaps classical Greek and Roman antiquity, is perhaps a sufficiently remote place for people to go find and search for answers. So it's sufficiently remote place geographically, right? We're talking about something that people appropriate from a smaller geographic area in Scandinavia, temporarily far removed. Perhaps the current population of this place is also small enough that the stakes are maybe a little bit lower if I go and borrow appropriate content from these areas than would be the case if I weren't to go, you know, search for answers in other cultures. So that's perhaps just one answer here.
Yeah, thank you. Zach, I know you've been thinking about this as well. What are your thoughts on this rather weighty subject?
Yeah, I have a lot of ideas about this. First of all, I think part of what's pulling this in is the history of the use. If you go back to the 16th, 17th century, I mean, Sweden and Denmark were using Old Norse literature in order to sort of exclude each other, right? So the sort of exclusion and use against someone else, although, you know, we wouldn't say race, has a rich history. And you can go into the 18th century and see this. And of course, the 19th century is where all this problematic, you know, pseudo scholarship comes from. And then we have, you know, Nazi Germany, is their affiliation with this. So there's a long, extensive history of different people using this as sort of a way to say you're not like us. And I think kind of going off what Rene said a little bit, is that the Norse and the Vikings, if you want to call them that, they were sort of underdogs in a way that maybe the classical world and the Romans were not, right? The Romans were this big empire, and the Greeks, you know, had their democracy. And so there's this romantic look at the Vikings and the Norse, that they were sort of this really rich culture that was sort of, you know, ruined, if you want to say that, by Christianity. Mm-hmm. And there's this real romantic look at sort of these underdogs. And because of the sort of ethnic relationship between, you know, if you want to use the word Teutonic, right, that was a big word in the 19th century, this sort of relation of people in the U.S., or perceived relation to the Norse, that they said, oh, these were our people, they were oppressed, and we sort of want to tap into this this vigorous people, you know, that sort of fought against the system almost. And the last thing is I know Verena is familiar with this book, Gods of the Blood by Matthias Gardel. And the metaphor that he uses in this book is a smorgasbord, and that the far right seem really not to put a lot of thought sometimes into what they choose to represent them. And it's sort of just, I like this, I like this, I like this, this seems to fit, this is a cool symbol. And so to some degree, there are a lot of people who put a lot of thought, and there's also just people who'd put on a helmet with a cool rune on it without really a lot of thought into it. And I think there's just sort of this grabbing at anything that sort of maybe bolsters that line of thinking.
Sure.
Does that mean, I mean, we think about this as having kind of a specific relevance for the field of medieval Germanic studies, right? I mean, it kind of sounds, Zach, like you're angling toward, this is really a problem potentially for all subfields of history, that if you're taking a grab bag or smorgasbord approach to the appropriation of history, it may start with a Norse or Germanic or Teutonic base, but other things are going to be grafted onto that.
For sure. I mean, sometimes it's hard to talk about Old Norse reception without talking about Tacitus, right? So these things are intertwined. And for me, it's hard for me to separate, you know, or just blame the 19th century. That's sort of the easy thing to do. But there are links in a chain that sort of built up to the relationship that we see now. I think it's fairly complex to pick it apart and say, you know, this is what attracts them, because I think it's a whole lot of different ideas. I think every field is should be at this point stepping back and analyzing a little bit about their own scholarly history.
I think both of you have touched on a similar kind of idea that modern people in general, I think people throughout history as well, they're seeking to construct an identity for themselves, seeking to know kind of who they are. And one of the things that they do is look backwards to other places. And this is something that happens on the far left and the far right, as people are kind of picking and choosing things that, as you said, kind of they're going to the feast table and they're picking the things that they like the best and putting them together on their plate because it speaks to me in some way. So there's something very human in it. But unfortunately, these things can often get twisted into narratives that are extremely problematic and, of course, not founded in any kind of historical reality.
I think what also comes in here is, of course, the very recent interest that people have developed in their ancestry, right? And we're trying to find out who we are and where we belong and create identity through using these modern technologies. And along came then, of course, this revolution in DNA research, that all of a sudden we can actually trace who we are by means of DNA research through services such as 23andMe, Ancestry.com, and so on and so forth, which all of a sudden gives people access to the ancestry that they have encoded in themselves, in their bodies. And as a result, people have started to also create online communities based on how they believe they're related to each other and their ancestry. And this, of course, brings then a lot of people to Northern European cultures, because they discover they are in some percentage and place, perhaps descendant from people who used to live in Scandinavia, Germany, or elsewhere in Northwestern Europe. And so it gives people this idea that that's actually a category that can create a sense of belonging and identity. That's not necessarily bad, and doesn't necessarily lead people into, you know, radical ideas per se, but I think it has created perhaps a more ubiquitous use of the idea of ancestry and ethnicity as identity markers than perhaps was before the case. And so that's something that's actually happening here too, right? That people explore their ancestry. And I mean, when you go to a place like 23andMe and you sign up and you actually get their ancestry report, I mean, you get the ancestry report, and the next thing you see is you get actually links to explore traveling to the places where your ancestors come from, cultural links. And it's a really small step then from there that people start exploring, okay, what was actually the culture of my ancestry here. And of course, people pick and choose ancestry that they find interesting and appealing. And of course, you know, stuff that is somehow related to the medieval cultures of Scandinavia has an appeal because it is very ubiquitous in US popular culture, right?
Yeah.
I mean, Vikings are sexy, let's face it. They have an appeal. They're sort of the stand-in for all pre-civilized people, right? For the sort of interesting other people, especially if you have an interest in counter culture, if you're perhaps not too happy with the common current status quo, if you're frustrated for some reason, I think, you know, it may lead people to actually search and explore Viking culture also because it stands in for something that is not the current status quo and reflects perhaps some cultural schisms that are currently going on in the United States, right? People's frustration over globalism, capitalism, over the political system, their frustrations over their perhaps the promises of the American dream that were never fulfilled to them, the situation of people who live in the US, you know, in non-coastal United States, somewhere in the Midwest, who just don't advance.
One of the things that you're really highlighting there, and I think quite rightly, is that there is a fracturing of community and a fracturing of identity that happens in the modern world. And people are turning to the internet, ancestry, and what they're looking for is belonging. Right.
But that, of course, means people are then finding their own path once they start looking for those group identities. Right. Verena, one of the things that your article highlights is that there are various pagan and heathen communities that are also grow out of this interest in the past. And you differentiate between the universalist communities like Troth and the more Volkish communities, the Asatru Folk Assembly, for example. Can you tell us a little bit about the distinctions between those groups and their attitudes toward race or gender identity? What separates them from one another that might lead someone in one direction or another when they start looking for that group identity?
Before I talk about the AFA and the Troth, I'd like to say that I've actually met quite a few practitioners of heathenry in the past 6 years. I teach a large lecture course on mythology here at the University of Illinois, and I also teach Old Norse Icelandic, both the language and the literature, sagas, poetry, runes, all that stuff. And so I've been meeting a lot of people. And I must say, before I talk about these two groups, that I've met a very diverse group of folks there. So I've met many solo practitioners, people who are actually not part of an organized group, people who use the internet as a source of information for their faith and spirituality, and who also connect to other people through the internet who share the same spiritual interests. And so these people will not feel represented at all by what I'm about to say. But I'd like to acknowledge that they exist. And also I'd like to acknowledge that there is a constant and I think a rapid development in the way heathen communities and heathen individuals, people who believe in Ausatru in the US, understand their faith and how they develop their practices. And so I think that is important to be said beforehand. So, you know, I've met, just to give an example, I've met people who worship Loki. I met people who feel a spiritual connection to the god Thor. I've met people who are in the LGBTQ community who are fascinated by Seder magic, by shamanism. But I also met people who are active in the AFA, who are about to enlist in the army, actually, or who are in ROTC. I also met a Godi or priest chieftain of the Troth. And as far as I'm concerned, All of these people are welcome in my class. I'll answer any of their questions. I'm happy to teach all of them Old Norse or Icelandic or read the Eddas with them. So my personal vantage point is that of a teacher first and foremost, and then secondarily, I would say as a researcher. So somewhat pragmatic if you want. And the two articles on the subject that I wrote because I wanted to understand what brings all these different people to classes in medieval Norse culture, and also to understand the kinds of questions that concern them. And I also wanted to learn how I can actually make sure to create a space, a classroom atmosphere, if you want, where I'm respectful and inclusive of heathen practitioners, no matter where they come from. Of course, I want to ensure that my classes are also a welcoming space to students of color, to students of varying ability. And I also really wanted to find a way to address what I think are misconceived notions about race and whiteness in the Middle Ages, but address that in a way that I do not immediately repel some students. I actually want to invite them to be part of a conversation and not just talk down to them. So that's really important to me. And I really wanted to frame my answer today first by saying this. So to get to your question now on universalist and folkish communities, Zach will say a little bit more about that too, perhaps, but the universalist position in the US is most prominently represented by an organization called the TROS, formerly called Ring of TROS, which was co-founded by someone called Stephen Flowers. Some of your listeners in the audience will perhaps know him under the name of Edred Thorsson or Thorsson. He has published quite a few books on runes and runes and magic. The TROS is really more an umbrella organization than it is an actual fixed group. So it's very decentralized. Members congregate in small groups. They call these small groups kindreds. This is the same for the AFA, by the way. So a kindred can really be anything. It can be a family unit. It can be a large gathering. And these kindreds are really in charge of their own events, as long as they do one TROS-sponsored public event annually, and also as long as they're not in violation with the inclusion statement that the TROS has. And I think that says a lot already, right? This organization, umbrella organization, has an inclusion statement. And that inclusion statement states, and I printed it out here, so I get this right, that it states that all TROS members stand against any use of Germanic religion and culture to advance causes of racism, sexism, homophobia, white supremacy, ableism, or any other form of prejudice. Quite a few members of groups that are affiliated with the TROS have signed a document called Declaration 127 or 127, which states that they do not discriminate against non-white or LGBTQ individuals, and also contains a pledge not to use any traditions to justify prejudice on the basis of race, nationality, orientation, or gender identity. Andy and John, you can perhaps post a link to this declaration. It's published on the blog site of Hugin's Heathen Hof, now in version 2. And so perhaps some people in your audience may want to look at this. It's been ratified by, I think, close to 200 organizations and close to or even over 20 nations so far. And the declaration gets its name from a poem in the Havamál, which basically states that you have to speak up when you recognize evil. So I think it's quite obvious that practitioners and groups that are affiliated with the TROS are very inclusive to any members of, regardless of gender, right? And of course, regardless of ethnicity or race. This declaration 127 is specifically directed at the AFA or the Ausatru Folk Assembly that formerly was known as the Ausatru Free Assembly. So this is really specifically the target of this declaration. So who is the AFA? In its present form, it was founded in 1994, but it existed before that under a slightly different name. It was founded by Stephen McNallan, that may be a name also familiar to people in your audience, formerly a soldier, also a teacher, juvenile corrections officer is an interesting biography. Stephen McNallan retired in 2016, so now the person in charge, the Als Herr Jagodi, as he is called in the AFA, is Matthew Flavel. I looked around on their webpage recently and I saw that they currently say they consist of altogether 24 kindreds throughout the United States. They have a temple in California, Grass Valley, and they have two more buildings or large congregation spaces in the United States. Most recently, they converted a formerly Lutheran church in the north of Minnesota in Murdoch to be one of their gathering spaces. The AFA is an organization that promotes a völkisch position, an ethnicist and völkisch, I would say, position. If you look at their statement of purpose, which you can easily find online, they will say that the preservation of ethnic European folk and their continued evolution is their goal. They even add a disclaimer here, let us be clear, and I'm quoting now directly, by ethnic European folk, we mean white people. Okay, so this is an organization dedicated to the evolution of white people. But they're also a new religious movement, of course. So what they're doing really is promoting the connection between race and religion. So what that means is that they understand religion as an expression of a racial soul, really. This goes back to a view that was inspired by Swiss psychoanalyst C.G. Jung, who had a theory of archetypes or Archetypenlehre that he published about in the first half of the 20th century. And he wrote a very controversial essay in 1936 called Wotan, Woden or Odin, if you want, Stephen McNallan actually refers to very frequently as sort of a foundational document for his idea about race and religion. If your audience wants to read a little bit more about that, I explain that in my articles. So what in this view, heathen gods and goddesses are really understand as an expression of a collective unconsciousness of specifically a white race, if you want. The idea here is that the information and that religion is genetically transmitted. This is a theory that Stephen McNallan now calls metagenetics. So culture and religion is really a matter of genetic inheritance. It's your genetic ancestry that sort of transports on a unique collective soul of your particular race in this understanding. So your body, your mind, your spirit is shaped by the evolutionary history of your ancestry, really, of your ancestors. And this is why when answering the first question today, I spoke about ancestry, because what the AFA sells to people and what makes them so dangerous, in my view, is the connection of ancestry and biological heritage to religion. So the claim that Ausatru is a religion of ethnic Europeans and for ethnic Europeans only is what I think is just so incredibly dangerous. So the term ethnic European folk that they use in AFA understanding really, it seems very flexible. Initially, there seemed to have been a somewhat narrow understanding or definition that that would only refer to people with Northern European ancestry. But if you look now, really, the definition includes folks with ancestry from Iceland to Russia. That's how they define themselves. And of course, what we're talking about here really is people who live in the United States, who have been living in the US for generations, but who define their ancestry as such. So ancestry really is key here. If you really think about and analyze what they do and also analyze the kind of rhetoric that they display publicly on the internet, they're a political organization, really. That's not just my view. That's the view also of Jennifer Snook. And it's also the judgment of the Southern Poverty Law Center, who actually lists them as a white supremacist hate group as of 2018. Stephen McNallan, though, the founder, would reject the label racist. He would reject the label white supremacist, of course. And we should mention that he has expelled extreme neo-Nazis from this organization in the past. But if you look at the content he posts, I mean, what you see is that he ultimately really voices the same rhetoric, defensive rhetoric that you see very commonly among people in the alt-right in the United States, but then also people among the so-called identitarian movement in Europe. And that is that the future of the white race is in imminent danger. They claim that white people could become effectively extinct during the next century, that the dropping population and intermarriage with other races poses an immediate danger here. And so combating this development in the US, but also in Europe, is the outspoken goal of the AFA and of Stephen McNallen. And that, to me, makes them a political organization, because Stephen McNallen specifically says, you know, Europe will be majority non-white within a couple of decades, unless, as I intend, we change the situation. This was a direct quotation from Stephen McNallen. And he actually went so far as to support an organization called Defend Europe in 2017 that crowdfunded money, I think $200,000, to charter a ship in the Mediterranean, a 422-ton ship to be precise. And that ship was trying to block boats transporting and rescuing also refugees coming from the Middle East and Africa who were trying to reach European shores. So we're talking trying to block boats from Doctors Without Borders here. And I think that says enough about who Stephen McNallen is and who the AFA is.
Sure.
So, I mean, there's a variety of groups in the American heathen scene. It's constantly changing. Chances are, as we speak, that what's going to be said is already outdated. But I think there's a general divide that has been described by scholars of paganism. Zach earlier mentioned Matthias Gardell as a Swedish scholar. Then there's Stephanie von Schnurbein, a German scholar, who've looked extensively into this. And they've noticed that there's this division between more universalist movements who are actually open to any kind of member as new religious movements who accept people regardless of their race, sexual identity, ability, who understand themselves as a very embracing form of religion, perhaps also eclectic form of religion. And then there's those who say that the kind of heathenry they practice is actually reserved for people who are, and this is again a quotation actually from the Ausatru Folk Assembly, the religion of ethnic European folk. So the idea here is that there is a connection between people's ethnicity and the religion that they carry out.
Both von Schnurbein and Gardell, they break it into three groups actually. And I think that the distinction between the other two is very important, because there's the universalist, the outright sort of racist, and then this group, the sort of towing the line of ethnicity. And that's where I think a lot of people get frustrated, because I think some people try to get on one side, some people try to get on the other. And so there are groups out there that are very much like, if you're not white, you can't come in. And then there's others that try to maybe break it down a little bit to sort of figure out who really belongs in there.
So, I mean, it's good to point out that there's actually more nuance, yeah. And von Schnurbein also calls the universalists a racist, because many of them reject just race as a category. So they're not, you know, they just reject the conflation of biological heritage and religion, if you want. Mm-hmm. But they're not openly, I don't know, not necessarily activist in their outreach.
Sure.
Really, it sounds like to a large degree that what people end up concluding about these things depends on what they go into it looking for. That a person who seeks an ethnocentric understanding of the religious history will find groups that will support that. Someone who goes into it with a more open idea about what the religion means and what the history is will also find groups to support that.
Oh, definitely.
And that, so what you seek is what you find.
Yeah.
Now, one of the things that I find so fascinating about this subject, whether it's the religious, the spiritual, social, or political draw back to the Viking Age, is that these groups are all working with the same source materials to construct their narratives of selfhood and to establish or reestablish a sense of the culture that they're looking for. And you both, of course, have more experience researching these groups than we do. So what texts do these communities turn to most often? Are they reading the same text? Are they reading different texts? How are they interacting with these source materials?
I mean, to some degree, I mean, there's only so much material, so it's going to be, you know, Havamal, Snorri's Edda, and a few other things smattered here and there. What I find really fascinating about these religions is the sort of inventiveness when it comes to ritual, because when you turn to the Eddas or to Havamo, you get some, you get some wisdom, you get some understanding of maybe who prayed to what god or what the gods were for, this sort of thing. But the sources are really scant on ritual, and Stephen McNellan and the Ausatru group, to start each session, he walks around with this giant hammer carved with runes, and it's sort, it's like, I guess the hammer represents the hammer of Thor, or this goes back to some obscure tradition or something. And there has to be some inventiveness going on. And so, yeah, to answer your question, I think it's the same sources being interpreted in radically different ways, because I can't imagine bringing any of that from reading any of the Eddas. It's just like, oh, this is like old stories, to me.
I know one of the things my students are most disappointed with when we go through the Norse mythology section and we get into the discussions of Norse religion is that, first of all, so much of it is filtered through a Christian lens. And then second of all, that we really don't have any preservation of a ritual culture from the period. And so they look at the modern societies and religions and say, well, where are they getting that stuff from? And you kind of put up your hands and say, well, it's invented, but it doesn't mean it's not meaningful to them. Because that's how ritual kind of comes into being, but it's not grounded in a historical reality as far as we know.
No, I mean, there's the problem of, let's say, the more reconstructionist leaning heathens and those who define themselves as neo-heathen and who are maybe a little bit more open to creatively adapt some historically documented practices, but perhaps also take over elements of other faith systems, who maybe are familiar with Wiccan practices or from other practices from other religious movements. Yeah, I mean, there is a fundamental problem with the sources, and I should frame this the following way. So all I know is basically from reading up from Jennifer Snook's amazing book called American Heathens, which I can highly recommend to your audience, because this is a book written by a sociologist who's actually a heathen practitioner. And so she really describes, she's a member of the Troth, who tried to get into the Ausatru Folk Assembly, and her application was denied because of her multicultural leanings, which I think is a very interesting thing. And she also, yeah, she talks about the importance of lore, which is what in heathen circles this is called, of course, the knowledge of the sources and then the derivation of some sort of ritual practices from them, or the rejection of those, right? And I mean, the sources are limited, right? There is only that much. We have the two Eddas, we have the Icelandic sagas, we have some runic inscriptions, we have some archaeological finds that are sometimes creatively interpreted. And those are taken by, I would say, all the heathen groups. And the way that these groups deal with it is, as I said, in at times more reconstructionist, strict, bookish perhaps also, where people are frowned upon if they do not have knowledge of Old Norse, if their Old Norse pronunciation is bad, or if they can't produce and verify the sources that they're using when they're doing a specific cultic practice perhaps. And then those who are a little bit more interested in maybe personal spiritual revelation and define themselves as neo-heathen. I mean, in terms of what people do, we know from the sources that people have done some kind of rite called blot, that probably was a kind of sacrifice, right? We know that Thor's hammers were important to some, and that at least in the mythology, Thor actually uses his hammer at least on two occasions to sanctify something. So Stephen McNallan, who founded the Ausatru Free and later Folk Assembly, has actually created a hammer rite that is used to sanctify spaces before heathen gatherings and the celebrations happening there. And then there's some kind of drinking rites that people have also produced, based perhaps on what we find described about the winter nights and drinking festivities in the saga. So, I mean, the sagas have, they mention things here and there, of course, heavily filtered, heavily manicured, heavily censored to adhere to the tastes and flavors of a Christian audience and the interests, antiquarian interests, I should say, perhaps of Icelanders in the 13th century, but there is some content there, right? We have a description of a pagan temple in Eyrbyggja saga, for instance, that is oftentimes used where blood is sprinkled, right? And certain activities take place where oaths are sworn on a sacrificial ring on an altar. The source has been deconstructed and shown to be heavily reliant on other sources. And, I could go on about that, but that's perhaps not as much of interest to you, to the audience right now. But it seems like the same sources are used by all groups, but very creatively interpreted, up to the point where perhaps one of the most, if not the most important text for American heathens, Hávamál in the Edda, Zach mentioned this poem before, has been used as a moral code of sorts, right? People have derived some kind of rules and ethnic standards from this text that they call the nine noble virtues, that sort of are perhaps a response to, you know, the Judeo-Christian tradition of the Ten Commandments, that sort of are supposed to express a set of behavioral standards for heathen people.
The challenge then is that it seems like, since we acknowledge that all the texts that are available are to some degree filtered through a sort of post-pagan lens, every text that is available and every interpretation of those texts are ahistorical to some degree or another, which means we who are trying to argue for a more academic approach to these subjects, or at least a less extremist approach, are arguing for a more historically verifiable ahistoricality, which is a which is kind of a difficult, it's a difficult and nuanced position to be in, right? That's a it's a difficult product to sell on the market of ideas.
Definitely, yeah. And it's a big problem, yeah. But I mean, that's the problem when religion meets scientifically verifiable academic research. I mean, that's a problem that a lot of religions face, a lot of reconstructive religions face, right? This is by no means reserved to American heathenry. I mean, Celtic reconstructionists have the same problem. Those who reconstruct ancient Egyptian or Latvian or Slavic belief systems have the exact same problem, right? That's the problem between the practitioner and the academic, us or the historian, perhaps. And the tension is there. I mean, the tension is also there, you know, in the Christian and in Judeo-Christian tradition, in the Abrahamic religions. I mean, those tensions exist, right? They're what religion does to us, and that make it so fascinating in many ways. Yeah.
And I wrote this quote down because I thought it was really interesting. Carl Siegfried has acknowledged that there's a need for these the more inclusive groups to define themselves in opposition to racist ideology. And maybe that same responsibility rests with academics to study the subject as well. But he also says that he doubts whether anti-racist work can stop that misappropriation of the past. And this is a quote: "Those who seek validation for hateful views will always manage to find some passage they can interpret in a way that justifies their bigotry." Certainly, there's no shortage of other religious imagery mixed in among these groups, right? We think about the Christian imagery of the Ku Klux Klan in America, for an example of that. Do we just have to reconcile ourselves to this, to a small number of people who will willfully twist any text, any tradition, any religion? Is this a matter of winning a battle for messaging rather than trying to make the field of Norse studies hate-proof?
Yes, it is impossible. I think that wherever you go, there's going to be people that want to take any sort of ideas or ideology to make them their own. And you know, to use your, you know, example of Christianity and the Ku Klux Klan, how many horrific things have been done, you know, in the name of Christianity over centuries. And I think that, you know, awareness of this history is probably just the first step. And I don't think that you can hate proof the field, but in my opinion, one of the things that has bothered me in the post Charlottesville discourse, you know, that this is a part of, this sort of real focus on white supremacy in the field of medieval studies, is that a lot of times it focuses almost too much on the fact that, hey, this should not be a part of this field of research, rather than this has no part in this field. And I think that there are people who are researchers or people that want to be scholars that maybe feel a little bit vulnerable. And I think the focus has been maybe too much on the outside of saying we need to hate proof this field without reflecting that there are people in the field that this really affects. And, you know, there's been a group that has emerged, the medievalists of color, that have done some really great work and really voicing this. And you know, I probably should have mentioned this, but I just taught my last class of the semester on this topic of racism and white supremacy in the field of medieval Norse studies and medieval studies. And one of my students, and I asked for her permission to share this. So she's Puerto Rican, so maybe not your stereotypical Norse scholar, right? But she said that her family and her friends back home, as well as her European classmates, confronted her and said, why would you want to study this when there's no relation, there's no heritage here? And just, you know, she knows that it's an innocent thing, you know, but it sounds like, what are you doing in this field? Right. And I think that has, I've heard from a lot of different of my colleagues that are from different backgrounds that this is sort of a bothersome approach, that we're sort of shocked when someone from that's not white or from the US or from Northern European is part of this field. And I think maybe the first step to sort of hate proofing this is to secure ourselves to make sure we're not asking these strange questions, and that we're making our colleagues feel like they are safe and giving contributions, and that we respect their opinions, you know. And so I think it should be more reflective on what's going on in here, and then we can start to sort of move outward. Although we shouldn't ignore, you know, what's going on, of course. But I think as far as real change, that could probably be the first step.
I mean, I would say I wholeheartedly agree with what Carl Siegfried says. There will always be people, everything can be vilified. and religion especially so, because religion is oftentimes, I mean, religion is, faith is indisputable, right? And if you don't find a way to justify whichever marginal view you have, you make it part of some kind of faith. and it is, you can defend it, right? Nobody can prove you wrong if that's what your belief is. So I think that's just inherent in the nature of religion per se, and some other fields too. I don't want to just beat on religion here. So, you know, I don't think we will ever hate proof the field. And I think that would also, that shouldn't be our goal, frankly, nor perhaps should our goal be to win a battle of messaging. I think perhaps what we need to do is just discuss more, have more debates, invite more people, invite more opinions. And it was in the US an entire feud fought around one medievalist of color who'd been even, I mean, doxxed by the worst right-wing people and exposed to a lot of hate. And I think what we as colleagues need to do is just discuss what's happening in our field, right? But I mean, there will always be people who will have radical opinions. Some of them will change their minds, some of them won't. But I mean, we just need to be openly discussing what's going on. But I mean, again, belief systems invite people's, you know, hateful opinions as much as they help other people, you know, lead fulfilled, happy spiritual lives and raise happy families. I mean, all of this is just inherent in the nature of religion and religious movements. So I think if anything, we will not win a battle of messaging, but we can perhaps just be careful to have more open discussions, make sure that we actually adhere to the principles of academic freedom, and they may include people who are practitioners of heathenry, they may include people who are more on the liberal or more on the conservative sides. We need to create, of course, spaces in which people are, you know, all people are thriving. So we need to make sure that all of these people can actually have productive conversations with each other in the space that we create. And that should perhaps be the goal. I mean, that sounds a little bit kumbaya and happy-go-lucky, but that I think ultimately should be our goal that we have, right? To not win battles of messaging, but to make sure that people can actually have meaningful conversations and make their points heard in a respectful manner and, you know, without uttering hate speech. And that means, I mean, that to me, after, you know, seeing more and more students showing up in my class with sort of badges of, you know, that said barbarian or masculine triumph, and they had these paraphernalia that clearly marked them as people who were interested in the alt-right. I mean, seeing more and more of these students, you know, I was wondering what to do. And ultimately, what I would like to do is just to have more conversations with these students and make sure that everybody else in class does too, and that we actually understand each other and don't just go along what is now commonly called cancel culture, right? To ostracize people for their sometimes radical, sometimes stupid, sometimes ridiculous, sometimes actually justified opinions, because we don't like them or because they scare us. So I think, you know, if you cancel people, if you battle them, that means you're afraid of them. But I think we should get to a point where we actually maybe have the toolkit we need to comfortably discuss with people in a civilized fashion, right? Because otherwise we're just feeding into people's conspiracy theories and a lot of the preconceived notions that people who sympathize with the right or, you know, identify as very, very conservative have, namely that the academy is liberal, you know, and that it's a sort of governed by cultural Marxists, people who want to, you know, erect a monoculture, you know, by radical feminists. I think that's something that some people maybe think about me, right? And I would actually contest and be very confused if I was called that. But and I think, you know, ways to go about that we're perceived like that and to tackle that fact is actually by instead of confirming these fears and maybe conspiracies that people feed into by just offering conversation and discussion to people.
Yeah.
You know, I totally agree with Verena, because in the aftermath of Charlottesville, there were so many articles that tried to reclaim the narrative, that tried to win the battle of the messaging. And you could see a pendulum swinging back the other way, which Verena says is just as dangerous. And I think it's listening to what people have to say. And like we're doing now, you know, there's such an awareness of it to discuss, to listen, to dig a little bit deeper, rather than saying, no, here's the correct way to do this, especially when you're talking about interpretations of, you know, medieval texts.
And the trick is to balance that against, Zach, as you were saying a moment ago, the importance of providing a safe environment for that to happen for all the people who are participating, right? I mean, the example you gave of the scholar of color who was doxxed and attacked online, but that was initiated by other scholars, but that was not something that came from an extremist non-academic group. That came from other scholars in the field.
And even between two women, I should mention here.
Yeah.
So it doesn't follow the usual narrative here of, you know, the sort of the young woman of color and then the evil white supremacist men who, I mean, that's not how it worked, right? It went along some different lines here, which is also, I think, very telling and interesting and shows us just that things aren't perhaps so binary and polarized as we often perceive them in this very, very loaded political environment that we're in right now.
Now, speaking of perception, I want to shift the focus of the conversation a little now to talk about how we perceive the construction of race. I know this is an important topic for modern interactions and interpretations of race in medieval culture. And Zachary, I believe you quoted Andrew Galloway's argument before on your Twitter feed, where he says that the further back one goes, the less focus is on race as an essential element of identity, and the more it is on religion, language, and family. So again, that quote's from Andrew Galloway, but I think it addresses an important issue, and I'm glad you highlighted it. We've seen Geraldine Heng write brilliantly on the subject in her book, The Invention of Race in the Middle Ages. And it's something that, honestly, John and I have come up against quite a few times on the podcast, especially when we encounter the different depictions of characters from other cultures or characters like the Blaumother, for example. And what we've concluded is that, at least in the sagas, it seems that race is far less important than one's ethnic identity, kind of like Galloway said. It's about where you're from, what god or gods you worship, that kind of thing. So, Zach, I'm going to start with you on this one. How can we navigate things like attitudes towards racial identity in medieval texts like the sagas when our own conception of race is so deeply influenced by our specifically modern preconceptions?
That's a very good question. It highlights this interesting crossroads that we're at, and the, you know, that we are thinking about race, that we're talking about race, and there are two, you know, real dangers in this, and that is, like the Blau men. I read an article not too long ago where there was this use of critical race theory talking about this group of people, but then on the other hand you have these historical texts saying, well, race wasn't really a determining idea until 16th, 17th century. So how do you balance these two ideas? And I don't know the answer to that, but the fact is that we're thinking about it, and that is, I think, the important thing. That critical race theory being used for medieval texts, even if that idea didn't exist as we know it is a really important step to at least get the ball rolling in the right direction to get people talking. And I think as far as medievalism, like, you know, because I'm more of into medievalism than I am per se a medievalist. You find that that in works of medievalism, any past is past. And so what this helps you do is to sort of like, I'll give you a great example, like works about Vinland, whether it's films or novels or something. A lot of times you'll see the Norse encounter the natives with a real colonial American attitude and using phrases and words that do not appear in the medieval texts, but do appear in like colonial times, such as bestial metaphors or analogies or something like this. And knowing that, you know, like digging into that, you can sort of parse what is part of the medieval text, what is part of another area of the past. I don't know if it's possible to separate the two, but at least going into medieval texts, knowing that there is some danger there, but it's not a modern perception of race as we know it. Brianna, do you have?
I mean, this is a tough one, especially because the field of critical race studies is still fairly new, right? And that's application to medieval culture in our field, you know, just of Norse medieval culture. That's just been started to being looked at. You know, Richard Cole wrote about it. Ormand Jacobson, of course. And so this is tricky. And I don't know if I have a good answer to the question. I mean, one way to perhaps evade this really difficult discussion, what is actually a racial awareness and what is not, is by just talking about othering and actually examining othering in medieval texts. I think that's perhaps a better category. Or ethnicity and ethnogenesis. That's actually something that I personally did some research on. So when do people actually perceive themselves as some kind of ethnic community? And then who are the others? Instances of othering occur all over the place in medieval literature and in medieval Norse literature. You know, sometimes it goes along the lines of gender. Sometimes it goes actually along the lines of some kind of perceived phenotype, right? Of people being described as swarthy or blackish or dark, mm-hmm. For a variety of reasons, even within Iceland, of course, and within the sagas, right? And within a very prominent sagas that you've discussed and that you all know well, and that probably the audience knows well, such as Egil's saga. We have a family where there's people who are described to be beautiful and have a light phenotype, and then the swarthy, more difficult, unruly characters that are happening here. And I think where this brings us to is perhaps, you know, not at all to racial discourses, but just to perhaps understand also how we're cognitively framed to perceive people as other and what our rhetorical means are to describe them as other. And oftentimes it actually goes along the lines of a color scheme, even though, you know, from looked at from the outside, I mean, you know, in Egil's saga, we're talking here about people who are descendants from Norwegian people who are then described in specific ways. So I know I'm steering away here from actually giving a satisfying answer to this really difficult question, but
I think it's quite appropriate. And what both of you have kind of highlighted, I think very importantly, that we're at the beginning of kind of even paying attention to these issues in scholarship. And if you look at the history of scholarship, things take a long time to kind of tease out and figure out and even come to, I don't want to say accurate because that's inappropriate, but to come to some conclusions that there's some agreement on. And so we're in the first stages of that. This is part of that conversation. I think that's important.
As I said, there's exciting scholarship happening, you know, in the field, but it's fairly recent still. Richard Cole, Alman Jacobson, Ankrimur Vidalin wrote a really important study on monstrosity and othering.
Yeah. And I think that's how I've usually approached these kinds of questions. It has more to do with othering. And you mentioned kind of how we are cognitively aware of ourselves and to the world around us, right? For we define ourselves through difference and sameness, right?
Exactly. And I mean, ethnicity is a cognitive pattern, like to perceive people along ethnic lines is actually a way we are cognitively framed. I mean, that we know from neurobiology, right? And from brain research, mm-hmm. that's actually something that structures just just human thinking. Does it mean we have to accept it or we shouldn't discuss it? Absolutely not, right? But it is something that is just inherent in the way people think and perceive the world around them. And it is reflected in medieval culture as much as in modern culture. And it is absolutely there to be vilified by those who want to actually use and abuse those categories to make, you know, political arguments or you know, produce hateful speech or argue for like a revolutionary change in society or just work themselves off of feminists or whatever else they don't like. And, you know,
Isn't there this difficulty, though? I mean, a little while back, you both quite rightly pressed back against the idea of a war of messaging. But there is this problem of what we're saying here is argue for nuance, argue for reflection. And that is often an uphill battle against the much more kind of bumper sticker, slogan-y, very straightforward answers that can be given by people who do find essentialist answers, do find, for lack of a better term, black and white answers for questions like this. We look at something like the problem of social media, right? The speed that that discourse happens at, the speed that something like Twitter or Facebook or TikTok, and the way it seems to demand real-time instant answers to very complicated and what are for us very nuanced questions, that doesn't really play to the strengths of many academics. And we think about that discourse that happened on January 6th during the insurrection at the Capitol in America, when one of the rioters was seen wearing a horned headdress, along with a Valknut tattoo and some other pagan symbols. And a lot of medieval scholars leapt onto the internet to decry those symbols as being a kind of misappropriation of Norse history and mythology, and inadvertently contributed to a problem of obscuring a separate misappropriated history from indigenous people. Right? That was not a Norse headdress. It was an indigenous headdress. And many medievalists, well-intentioned medievalists, right, made that mistake in the desire to quickly enter the conversation. What kind of a response from the academic community is appropriate? And how can we balance the need for a quick response with the need for reasoned discourse?
One of the things that really bothered me about what happened on that day and in the aftermath was just the tunnel vision of so many Norse scholars were focusing on this weirdo guy. Meanwhile, we had some really dark things happening in the background and people were dying. And that, to me, I think spoke volumes about how seriously people took Charlottesville and sort of how focused they are on finding these things to decry them. And maybe that is part of the issue, is that so many people nowadays are on the lookout for something to say, I'm not with that, I'm against that, so that they can, you know, like Verena said earlier, like there's so much less face-to-face interaction that the best thing you can do to show who you are is maybe to tweet or to post something. And while, yes, this guy has some Norse tattoos and that's really bothering to a lot of people, it felt to some degree that the narrative took a really strange turn into Norse appropriate or, you know, alt-right or right-wing appropriation of Norse stuff. Meanwhile, why was there an insurrection? Why were those people in the Capitol? What about the people that passed away? Why was this such a violent act that the president may or may not have encouraged? And that was a red flag for me, that maybe the pendulum has swung a little bit too far to say, yes, this is something that needs to be addressed, but maybe we should step back for a moment and look at the bigger picture. So I don't know when it comes to social media, other than to say, whoa, those are Norse tattoos, bad job, you know, could have done better there. I think slowing down may be the best thing to try. I don't know.
I think I would go along those lines as well. Though I must say, I mean, this is really a question of personality and of the kinds of scholars we want to be or we do not want to be, right? Do we actually want to be the people who are out there, let's say, on the battlefield, doing the battle of messaging, of putting out our opinion, and then to some extent also allowing us to be instrumentalized by, you know, the those rules of social media that actually call for instant content, constant likes or dislikes, our evaluation of things, statements to be made. And, you know, that's edutainment or entertainment to me. That's not really actually the production of meaning and knowledge. And so personally, I like to actually resist the urge to always be online and to always comment. And I also like to resist to be part of the machinery that constantly needs to spread content and then gets wound up over details, over followers, over clicks and whatnot. I'm actually not interested in that at all. And I actually, I find that social media puts a lot of pressure and constraints on people. And I also like to think that what people do on the internet is oftentimes not an expression of who they are, of their personality or of a certain status quo, but they're on the search, right? They're testing things. They're testing identities. They're voicing opinions. They search for likes and followers. They want the dopamine kick of people liking them. And so for that reason, I think people felt the urge to comment right away when the photos of this particular individual, we're talking about Jake Angeli here, right? On January 6th, when these photographs surfaced, I feel that a lot of our colleagues were very quick to jump to the conclusion that, you know, this was a sort of picture book, alt-right or right-wing or radical heathen. You know, and actually looking a little bit more at him, and now I realize I'm partially contradicting myself, but I actually checked him out on Facebook. Maybe I shouldn't admit to this. So I was looking, of course I saw the photos, and of course I looked at his tattoos, and of course I saw the Valknut, and I saw Yggdrasil, which I think he has also on his chest, and I saw something that looked like a Thor's hammer. And then I saw him wear a headdress that has horns, but, you know, it's not really, I mean, is actually taken from Native American culture. And then I learned that he has a tattoo of the Mexican border wall in his arms. And so I had some preconceived ideas about him. I looked at his profile on Facebook, which he had out there. I mean, and I learned he is interested in UFOs, right? And he's actually interested in a multidimensional person. He's following some divine feminine and masculine ascending groups. I mean, there's a really wild mix here of hundreds and hundreds of things that he likes on Facebook that just indicate, you know, how perhaps complex he would call it multidimensional a being he is, but also just how contradictory and how ambiguous he is. And I think that goes for a lot of people whom we encounter, and based on symbols that they display, we take them to be a radical, neo-pagan, alt-right supporting person. And in reality, they're perhaps more complex. You know, they may be more complex and mentally ill in some cases, but in other cases, they're also just people testing identities, right? Showcasing things. And so
people
I think
people searching, right?
Yeah, people on the search. And I mean, we can, if we think of what we did 10, 15 years ago on the internet and what we do now, we will perhaps also conclude that we were on a search of sorts, or that we've developed as people. And so I think that's what's perhaps going on here as well. I mean, I don't mean to trivialize or play down the people who did these actions on January 6th. And I by no means want to distract from what Zach pointed out, namely that actually people died during this event and that there's some really serious things were happening here. But I'd also like to point out that if we are constantly labeling and classifying and responding to people, we are prone to make mistakes, and we are prone to trivializing people and to sort of boiling them down to fit into a very polarized depiction of the world, into sort of law adhering, proper, or, you know, nice people and criminals, or to sort of conservative and liberal people, or to radical heathens and universalist heathens. And so on. And in reality, people slide along scales, right? They're fluid, complex human beings. And we're really doing a disservice, I think, if as scholars we allow ourselves to be instrumentalized to constantly comment and be part of this machinery that is actually created by social media and which is just accelerating, right?
But I think this is in part because of what happened at Charlottesville. There was such an outcry among scholars. How did we let this happen? How did white supremacists become part of the field? And so because of, you know, that event created such an alarm that, you know, that that image of this man with the Norse tattoos and the fur helmet standing in the Capitol with, you know, all these things going on right there. It raised so many flags for so many people. Cause we, you know, no one wants to say, oh, I wasn't taking this seriously. Right. And so I think that, that there is this sort of like, I don't want to say panic, but there's this sort of need to say, I'm not part of the problem. So, yeah. You know, this guy is bad, which he was, you know, he's doing something terribly wrong. Who knows how much those Norse tattoos led him to that decision, right? Or how much that is a part of his identity. It's unsettling for sure to see it there, but
yeah.
He's a complex weirdo.
I mean, there's a lot going on there, and we should look at that as well.
For me, when I encountered those kinds of issues, the question that I like to ask, because it's really tempting to get caught up in the either virtue signaling or saying that's not me, or I'm protecting my field or whatever. But I also think like people like that represent cultural problems that we need to be as a culture aware of. Why? The question that I ask is why? Why are these people doing this? Why do they believe what they believe? Why are they susceptible to misinformation in the way that they are? These are bigger problems than just those individuals. Those individuals are symptoms of a larger problem, a cultural problem, something that we as participants in the culture need to be more aware of. And that's where, going back to Verena's earlier comment, it's really about communication. It's really about having open dialogue and being open to listening to other people's experiences and guiding our society forward rather than, you know, some of the things that seem to be driven more by divisiveness or greed or all the things we study in medieval literature, of course, that teach us how to be decent people, or at least try to.
I mean, in so many ways, this person, I think, reflects some of the cultural schisms we currently feel, right? He also represents what some people on the far right would perhaps consider to be more natural or unregulated state of human existence versus what they perceive to be these constraints of what they call, you know, monoculture and globalism that sort of boils everybody down in their perception, I'm saying here, to be, you know, to sort of, you know, feed into politically correct speech, you know, to adhere to principles of racial justice, of gender equality, of inclusivity. And so there's a lot of people who are frustrated by that and who are feel that they're no longer heard, who feel that they're unjustly regulated in their daily lives, right? And what people then turn to are symbols like this person who just represents sort of this visceral barbaric energy of times past. Now it doesn't matter now if we interpret him as a, you know, someone who's appropriating Viking Age symbolism here or maybe Native American, but he's somebody who also stands up for the idea that, you know, perhaps globalism is bad, capitalism is bad, the government in the US is run by corrupt people, democracy was stolen from us, right? This is what this rally was actually about. And mm-hmm. We need to rethink things, right? We need to actually rethink things. And the way to do that is to actually go back to, or we need to turn to principles from a barbaric past to rethink who we are and make the world a better place. Focus perhaps, you know, on violent action rather than on just, you know, the principles of democracy that have been undermined by corrupt politicians. You know, and steal back what belongs to us. And I think that's what this guy was symbolizing after all, right? And that feeds into just some notions we have about the Vikings as a people who you know, steal and pillage, who satisfy their sexual urges as they please, and who take violent action against and vengeance against things that have gone wrong, right? They symbolize this power and violence that, you know, a lot of extremely frustrated people who've sort of got lost along the way, in the past decades, perhaps in the United States, and who feel that the American dream has betrayed them, are turning to, right? There's this brilliant book by a sociologist, Russell Hochschild, Strangers in Their Own Country, about the Tea Party movement that, you know, just describes actually these lost people who feel alien in the United States, who feel that they were betrayed, whose hopes into a better future for themselves and their children have been betrayed, who are suffering from the effects of industrialization, pollution, the destruction of the environment. And contrary to what we expect, they're not turning to leftist progressive policies that could help them, but they're actually turning the other way, right? Into, into religion and into extremely conservative and to some extent also libertarian policies, and you know, want to live unencumbered by big government and lead their lives in the way they think they should.
And interestingly, I mean, we can look back at the past and see that the Icelandic sagas were written at a very similar inflection point in history. The writers of sagas were in a country that had recently submitted to Norway and had returned to rule by a king after centuries of identifying themselves by resistance to that rule, by resistance to that centralization of authority. And so the sense of that loss of independence, that loss of self-identity, fed that literature as well, that there is a parallel there. It may not be the one that the people trying to appropriate this stuff think it is, but there is a parallel to that inflection point.
Absolutely. I mean, they are an expression of nostalgia, if you want, for a time that is perceived to have been lost. And they've been called crisis literature by a Swiss scholar, I think, Thomas Fechner Smarsley, who said they were actually written, at the times of crisis when, you know, Icelanders perceived they were losing sort of their way of life and were idealizing to some extent their present, right? And were turning also to their past, I mean, idealizing their past, and were turning to ideas about it, their golden age past of saga times, right? During the very tumultuous time of the 13th century, right? I mean, and that's why we turn to the past, right? Oftentimes with what in memory studies is called a contra-present desire, right? We don't like the current present. We don't like the current status quo. We turn to the past to find for answers on how to change our life that we no longer like, right? And I mean, that to some extent, I think is for me the answer to the question that was asked first today. Why do people turn to medieval cultures and medieval content and perhaps to Old Norse content in particular?
And to speak to that, since we're coming to a conclusion here, the next segment of this, we're doing sort of three of these episodes, and the next segment will be asking a related question, just what, Verena, which you have just framed, if medieval ideas about identity and race aren't what we think or what people in alt-right groups think or are being sort of used for various ends that way, then what were they? Sort of what actually is the world that created this literature? What actually is the world that people are then imagining when they look at the past? We're going to have other experts on to speak about that. Is there a question you'd like to pose to them?
About putting you on the spot.
I don't know. You know, you could ask them the practical question, of course. So how do we actually adequately teach race in a medieval context?
Yeah.
I don't know, Zach, what are you thinking?
In 2018, I believe, or 2017, I went to a conference in Orkney, the St. Magnus Conference, and the title of that year was Alternative Facts and Actual Fiction. And it was sort of, you know, there were a lot of different presentations sort of about what was going on or sort of reflections of misappropriation or something like that. And one of the conversations that we had as a group, because it was a really small group in the conference, was how to avoid screaming into the void, right? In that, you know, we could write an article and publish it in a book, but if it's $120 through an academic publisher, you know, that's for a specific group of people and doesn't reach the people that maybe we want to get involved in this conversation, right? So one of the questions that I have not found a really good answer to is how to step around, you know, I don't want to be on 4chan late at night trying to say, you got this wrong. You know, that's not how it goes. But I also don't want to just write an article that three other academics are going to cite later on. I want to be able to engage in a real conversation with people in academia and outside academia. And maybe things like a podcast is a great medium for that. I know one colleague of mine is doing Twitch streams. I'm not sure what Twitch is, but I think you play video games on there and people watch it, is what I understand. And he does, he plays Viking video games. And as he goes along, he'll he'll discuss sort of like, this comes from this. This is definitely not historically accurate. This, you know, is an altercation of this. And I think that's a really interesting thing to do. And I think that sort of broadens the field, broadens the conversation a little bit. I still haven't found a really good example to sort of bridge, the great work that some people are doing. How do we get that? How do we get these ideas out to people that actually should be reading it, right? Or hearing this or learning about this. And I think that is a really tough mountain to climb.
Yeah, I can tell you, if John and I had a lot more time, we would do a lot more interviews, because I think these are great opportunities for us to learn things, to get in conversations with really interesting people, and to share with a broader audience than we necessarily would access through academic publishing.
I mean, you are definitely doing it, you know, through the podcast. You are communicating with a much wider audience here, you know, and bringing out ideas.
Yeah. We just have one final question for you guys. It's a light question. It's one that we ask all of our guests on the podcast. Do you have a favorite saga or text from medieval Scandinavian literature? This is a podcast primarily about the sagas of Icelanders. So we always like to get your opinion on which ones are the best. Zach, you want to go first?
Sure. Yeah. I recently went back through Landnámabók for a project with Emily Lethbridge. Here in Iceland, and I think that text is just really fascinating. It's one of my
interesting choice.
I know. I just think that as a whole, as a text, the fact that it's almost reads like a genealogy, and then they throw in some story about a wizard out of nowhere. It's really there's a lot more like dead slaves than I expected, than I remembered from the earlier times going through it. It's sort of a twisty turn story where it lulls you into this like boring, this guy came from here, this person settled here. And then just out of nowhere, these bizarre and really interesting stories that connect Icelanders to the land. And I think that's probably the really most impressive thing is the place names and how much is remembered and written down in this text. So. Mm. I know it's a strange answer, but I really love that book.
Certainly not one I would have expected, but it's a great answer.
Yeah, I'm shaking my head too, because I'm wrapping up a book about Ingólfur Árnason, the first settler of Icelanders, and he is, of course, featured very prominently in the Sturlubók redaction of Landnámabók, the first chapters, and so I've been reading and deconstructing that nonstop, and so I think I would not go with Landnámabók at the moment. Also because it tends to get a little bit formulaic later down the road, even though isn't there a really interesting passage about like an argument about a cow in there that I thought was really cool.
There's that. There's the Kvítramannaland that comes from Landnámabók, and so there's so many strange tangents throughout this seemingly boring book, but.
So I'm not a saga person per se. Maybe I shouldn't even admit that here, because you've probably expelled me now from here.
We tend not to interview many saga people, so it's okay.
Because I really like Eddic poetry and runic inscriptions. But if I was to go with a saga, I think I would go with Gísla saga or Saga of Gísli Sturluson, just because every time I read that, it gets me about this person who's tormented by nightmares, about, you know, family strife, incest, conflict, and then just this really amazing scene of his death and all brutality. Yeah. I think it's one of the best. It's a rather short saga. And I find also there's a lot of really ancient seeming details in it that I feel it has a very ancient feel to it, the way that blood brotherhood is described in it. And yeah, I would go with that one.
Mm, yeah. It's always one of my students' favorite, and it's one of the ones that I turn to. I think John and I have had this conversation on the podcast before. If you're trying to introduce people to sagas and capture kind of the essence of it, but also entertain them, Gísli saga is one of the best you can possibly choose. And it's also nicely, tightly written too.
It is tightly written, and it's beautiful, beautiful poetry in it too.
What's the most common answer that you get?
The most common answer is, I don't really read sagas. I don't know.
Although we have had multiple people say Ale Saga.
Of course. Yeah. And that's why I didn't want to say it. But man, that's I mean, where do you have a saga where someone writes about old age and, you know, dripping urine and, yeah, and all these sort of, how terrible it is to be an old man.
Yeah. Well, he's such a carefully constructed character. It's really, you know, when I always talk to other English professors and they have no sense of just how deep and complex Icelandic literature can be at such an early date. They just are blown away by that. And I think Eyjolf's a good example of what's possible in medieval literature.
Guys, thank you so much for being here. Thank you for doing this. I know this is a vexed topic. It's a difficult topic. And we really appreciate you coming on and trying to help our audience come to a greater understanding.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks.
Thank you very much. We appreciate it. And we'll see everybody next time.
Fyrir sér alvaran, hann rauður loginn.